On Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA, it is WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendine with us, horticulture educator from Penn State Cooperative Extension. We have Tom Butzler. Hello, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me on here today, Doug.
Quick reminder, if you have a question for him and you'd like it answered on a future show, doug@leitnerradio.com. And yes, you will find that information and links to what we're talking about on the podcast of this show after we play it on the air. We want to start off with gardening because now that Memorial Day is past, theoretically, we don't have any more frost. I'm not completely trusting that that never happens again before we get into the dog days of summer. But what's some of the first stuff that we have to look at as far as getting into gardening now?
Yeah, well, first of all, looking at the long-term forecast, at least for the next 10 days, I mean, there's no chance of frost happening. I'm not a betting man, but I just don't think we're going to get there. So, you know, it's great time to put in those warm season crops. And as we've talked about this before, Doug, that would be like your tomatoes, your eggplants, peppers, your cucumbers, things like that, that are really sensitive to that cold temperature, that frost, but will do fine now as we are warming up into these next couple months, these growing months. So the big crop, Doug, for almost everybody's garden is, take a guess.
Tomatoes,
absolutely, yeah. Everyone has to have a tomato plant in their garden. Some folks put in peppers or lettuce or, you know, beans and cucumbers, but almost everyone puts in a tomato. And there's so many varieties of tomatoes, you know, some for canning purposes, some for the salad, you know, your cherry tomatoes, some to put on your burgers. So those would be your slicers. They come in different colors. So, I mean, there's just a wide variety of tomatoes that people plant in their gardens, and they have different tastes and different uses. So, yeah, it's a big crop, but, you know, it's not a trouble-free crop. There are a lot of insects and diseases that can be problematic on these garden tomatoes.
There's all different types of blight, right?
Yeah, the two big ones that get a lot of press is the early blight and late blight. Now, I don't know why they named them, because they can occur flip-flop. Late blight could come before early blight, not usually, but they are two different organisms. Now, the one that we get every year is early blight. Late blight, that's kind of a hit-and-miss thing. When it does come and temperatures and rainfall is just right, it will wipe out a tomato crop. Whereas early blight, we get that every year, and it's kind of a slow-progressing disease. I mean, it will march on and take off the leaves of your plant eventually, but it's a little slower moving. So this is one that overwinters in our soils, and as we start getting into the warmer months and we get rainfall, these organisms that live in the soil will basically latch on or jump up onto the lower leaves. And it just progresses from the lower canopy of the tomato plant and slowly moves upward. Again, it's going to take several weeks, but you get leaves that are starting to fall off. And, you know, when you lose leaves, you lose photosynthetic surface. You might not get the flavor in the tomatoes. You might get some sunburn on the tomatoes. So you really want to try to preserve those leaves on the tomato from early blight. Now, there are a couple other similar diseases. There's septoria leaf spot, for example, but it too is a soil inhabiting organism. So if you're controlling early blight, more than likely you're controlling septoria.
Well, if you were to remove the lower leaves, would it have any real impact in preventing it, or would it just jump to the next tier?
So, I mean, that's a good question, Doug. It's not going to eliminate early blight, but it does help to kind of maybe slow it down or mitigate some of the damage. One of the big things with removing some of those lower branches is, yeah, it could maybe serve as a barrier. It's a little bit of space between the soil surface now and the lower leaves. But it also improves air circulation. And I think I've talked about this in some of your radio shows before, that most of your leaf diseases need water to start that infection process, So anything you can do to promote leaf drying, that reduces some of these disease issues. And so removing those lower leaves improves air circulation, and you get some quicker drying. I'm not going to say it eliminates all the water on your leaves, but it does give you a little bit of an advantage or leg up on controlling early blight.
Now, you have to let it grow tall enough where you're not decimating a good part of the plant by removing the lower leaves. I mean, if it's a couple feet high, that's fine. You can take a few off. It's not going to be a problem. If it's, you know, barely a foot high and you start removing leaves, you're hurting it.
Yeah, you want to make sure that you've got some pretty robust growth, you know, a couple feet high in that tomato plant before you start removing those lower leaves. Now, the other thing, we didn't touch upon this. Now, we've always talked about the importance of mulching, you know, conserving water, controlling weeds. But mulching in this instance creates a barrier between the soil surface and these lower leaves. As I mentioned earlier, this is a soil inhabiting organism. So basically, if you could cover it, you are reducing or eliminate the potential of this disease organism from moving from the soil surface onto the lower leaves. So that is another really good strategy to try to prevent early blight from getting an early start on you. Now, it won't eliminate it because you might have your neighbor's plants over, you know, a yard over that this organism is sporulating. And these spores will travel through the air. So eventually, they'll probably land on your tomato plant. But for your garden, preventing those spores from coming off, you know, the soil surface up onto your lower leaves, mulching will really inhibit that from happening.
You know, I've never, ever mulched a vegetable garden. Some that are flower beds, yes, but it's mainly been other shrubs around it, and there are flowers with that. How much do you put? Well, first off, I'm thinking, you mentioned spores, because I've seen spores in mulch, especially if you don't get clean mulch. You just happen to get some that's not that, you shouldn't have been using it, but you didn't know that until it was too late. But how much do you put for, say, tomatoes versus regular plants or non-vegetable plants?
Yeah, so a couple things. One is I think the mulch you're going to be using is a little different than you use in your landscape. In our landscape, we kind of like to go with that shredded bark, kind of a real woody material, something that's not going to break down for maybe a couple years or slowly break down. In the vegetable garden, we want something that's going to break down by the end of the growing season. So, you know, I personally, a couple things I use are shredded leaves that I accumulated from the previous fall, straw, you know, something that you can place around the base of the plant and allows water to get through, but it will just break down by the end of the summer, and then you can incorporate that into the soil. So you just need a couple of inches, and it's not real heavy stuff, whereas, you know, 3 inches of shredded bark, it's a little heavier, it's a little denser, thicker, but, you know, an inch or two of shredded leaves, that's enough to, one, conserve moisture, and two, to prevent some weeds from growing through, and three, creating that barrier between some of these soil-inhabiting disease microorganisms and jumping up on the leaves. So, yeah, it's not a bad thing to do. I had put some stuff into my garden, and there's one area that I did not mulch yet, and these aren't really hot days. I'll take the hot out of the equation. But these are sunny days with low humidity. And I was kind of surprised how quickly that soil was drying out. So I need to get some mulch there, especially for some of these newer plants you just put in. Maybe you just put in some peppers or tomatoes, or, you know, you seeded some lettuce or beans or whatever. Whatever it is, you probably don't have this well-established and deep root system. So that drying out of that inch or two of that topsoil can really put a crimp on that plant growth. So I was surprised how fast it's been drying out, and I need to get mulch there.
I don't think we have to mention this for sure, but just to make certain that people understand, do not use rubberized mulch for this. Am I wrong?
Yeah. No, you don't want to use rubberized mulch for a variety of reasons. One, it's not going to break down. It doesn't add any organic matter to the soil. And, you know, when you look at tires, if you would look at a list of ingredients, there's a lot of chemicals in there. And you just don't want that to, you know, you don't want that into where you're planting your food crop and the possibility of your vegetables coming into contact with it, or maybe some uptake. I don't know exactly what chemicals could be uptake through the roots, but it's just not, I really don't recommend that.
I saw some article online, and because it was online, of course, it has to be true. Somebody had done a study about using rubberized mulch in playgrounds versus just natural soil. And they said that it was far better for kids there to be natural soil there because there were fewer problems with respiratory concerns and other problems just in general, that the kids were a bit healthier around actual real, it doesn't sound like this is the way it would go, but actual real dirt or soil as opposed to something synthetic?
Well, you know, I'd have to read this study myself. My first thought is that, you know, as Americans, we try to clean everything. Our houses are, you know, we try to sanitize this and that. And I do think maybe there's a little bit of a disadvantage on our immune system when we're not exposed to the, you know, things, these microorganisms in the outside environment. And, you know, if we're exposed to these, our bodies kind of react to them and they build up an immune system or defense system. So, I mean, I could see maybe what they're saying, but I have seen, and it's been a while now, but I've seen some playgrounds with these shredded tires, rubber, whatever. And the thing that I took away from that is when it escapes that play area, you just have pieces of rubber all over the lawn area, and they'll be there forever until they get kind of pounded up, you know, into the soil profile.
Yeah.
So it just becomes unsightly as it just spreads out into the surrounding turf.
Even if you were to rototill that area, you still got the smaller bits of rubber in your soil. So what's the point of doing any of that?
Yeah, no, that's just not a use. Now, one thing I have seen is where they're using some sort of a rubber and they make it into a mat. So it's
far different. That's different.
Yeah.
It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen from Penn State Cooperative Extension. We have horticulture educator Tom Butzler. We were talking about tomatoes. We had talked about maybe removing the lower leaves if you have a problem with blight or something like that, or trying to prevent it, but that's not the same as pruning a tomato or trellising it or staking it. And what do we need to know about that?
Yeah, well, there's a lot there in that short intro there, Doug. So a couple things. One, when you look at tomatoes, they're grown a couple different ways in Pennsylvania. On a commercial scale, they grow a tomato and they just allow it to kind of flop on the ground, because they're going to come through with processing equipment and harvest them that way. And when you look at tomato gardens and farms that are growing it for their market stand or whatever, they're growing tomatoes in an upright fashion, trying to keep it off the soil. You know, you get cleaner tomatoes, it's less of a disease problem, and so forth. And so tomatoes are coming into two broad categories. We have these determinate cultivars or varieties where they grow at certain height and kind of stop growing and then they set fruit. And then we have these indeterminate varieties that can grow for just, if the weather's fine, they can just keep on growing and growing and growing and setting fruit. Now, typically we run into a frost event and that kind of shuts the plant down. But the determinate ones are a little shorter, and indeterminate ones, starts with an IN, can grow much higher. But in either case, you do want to stake them so you have an upright plant. Big thing, it makes it easier to harvest. It helps with some of the disease, because if it's laying on the ground, things get wet, you have poor air circulation, so upright does aid in that a little bit. If you're going to stake or trellis your tomatoes, just be aware with the determinate ones, you don't need as big of a stake. You know, they might get about 4 feet in height, whereas your indeterminate ones, you might have to have a taller system set up. Otherwise, if you use a 3-foot stake, it will grow, and then it will just flop over the top of the stake and then start bending towards the ground. Now, the other thing you mentioned was pruning. And again, that depends on what type of tomato you're growing. With the determinate ones, those shorter ones, I'm not sure you need to prune. And when I say prune, you know, these are the suckers that come out between the branches and the main stem. If you leave those behind, you get a very shrubby plant. I don't think it's that big of a difference with your determinant or your shorter varieties. Just kind of let that go. Now, one advantage is, as we talked about earlier, is if you do remove some of those suckers, you do get some better air circulation. So if you've got a susceptible cultivar that's susceptible to diseases, yeah, maybe prune out some of those suckers, those lower ones, not all of them. Typically what we say is prune out the suckers up to the first flower cluster. And so that improves air circulation. If you're growing those tall determinate ones, Yeah, you might want to prune out a couple of the suckers because you just get a really, really bushy plant if you don't prune out all those suckers. But, you know, if, I'm not going to say if you're a lazy gardener, but if you've got a lot going on in your life and you don't do any pruning, your plant's going to do fine. It's going to produce tomatoes. You're going to have tasty tomatoes. It just depends on kind of the level of input you want in your crop. A word of caution on pruning, Doug, is if you remove too much of those suckers and too many of the lower branches, your fruit now is exposed to that sun, and you can get some sunburning on that fruit. So you like somewhat of a canopy to provide shade, you know, during those hot summer days.
I wasn't aware the fruit could get sunburned.
No, I don't know if it would affect the taste or not. I guess I've never eaten a sunburned tomato, but it, you know, as consumers, we eat with our eyes before we, you know, put it in our mouth. So it makes it kind of an unmarketable product.
Well, wouldn't a sunburned tomato, before it gets to that point, it would be ripe enough that you'd pick it? Or is it you're going to go away one morning and come back in the afternoon and it's already turned by then?
No, you would have, more often than not, when I've seen sunburned tomatoes, it's on you can see that sunburning on the green. It happens before it's red.
Okay.
And so you get the damage of that tissue before it turns. So I guess maybe why I've never really tasted one is by that time, when it gets red, that damaged area is kind of rotting or it's just unsightly and I've never eaten it.
You know, I may have seen something like that, but I never thought of them as sunburned, but that makes makes a lot of sense in some of the ones I've seen that were unusable. I did have a tomato plant somebody gave me a few years ago, and I didn't have a stake with me, so I just let it go, and it did grow all over this area where normally I'd have a flower garden. And it was amazing. Yeah. The only problem was if any of the fruit started to form, I'd have to prop it with something so it didn't lay on the ground. Otherwise, that fruit would be rotten by the time. You know, one side of it would be bad, and you wouldn't want to eat it.
Yeah. We're not, you know, it's, you know, the tomatoes don't have that thick skin like a cantaloupe or a watermelon, which, you know, just lay on the ground until they're ripe and harvested. So, yeah, it's a good idea to keep them off the ground. What, you know, when you look at commercial production of tomatoes where they allow the plants to just basically flop over, you know, they have a pretty vigorous or disease spray schedule. And so that kind of minimizes some of the rot issues.
Hmm.
Well, the skin is thicker. I mean, you pick some of these commercial varieties, I mean, you can drop it from several feet in the air and it hits the surface and just kind of bounces along. So they're bred a little different.
I can see now the Super Bowl of tomatoes.
Yeah.
As far as trellising, what are the best varieties of tomato if you're going to do a trellis? And how high can you make them?
Yeah, well, any variety can be trellis. There's no, I don't think there's any list. I've never seen that. And how high? You know, you're going to want it, 4 or 5 feet in height at the most for the, you know, your determinant or, you know, your shorter cultivars. And you can use anything to trellis. I mean, people use stakes, and then they'll tie up the main stem as the plant grows. A lot of people use the tomato cages. That way they don't have to, you know, come back every other week and tie up the stem. It just kind of allows the plant to grow up in this cylinder. And, you know, the leaves poke out and the branches poke out, and it kind of supports itself. So, I mean, you could use anything that, you know, have available, tied up, or, you know, in some sort of a cage. And that does fine.
You know, while I was thinking about that, when you were talking about that, I thought of back when we had Tom Ford with us, there was a program we did that I still get people asking me about today. So I'm going to put a link on the podcast page of this program to that podcast. It was this woman in, I believe, Virginia or West Virginia, had these tomatoes that were growing as tall as her house. She'd been growing them for years. The seeds were very prized because she had somehow gotten them to be genetic that they would create these giant tomatoes, and seriously it would be as tall as a second story house.
Yep.
And
of your indeterminate ones. That's an example of an indeterminate variety. Yep.
Yeah, but it's amazing to me that I'll still have people ask me about that, and I don't know that I would have much success with that, but boy, it would be nice to try something like that. But the woman who originally started that, I guess learned by trial and error or just knew what she was doing, but it was amazing.
Well, you know, Doug, That's no different than when we talked about the giant pumpkins several months ago. I think, you know, everyone's familiar with pumpkins. Everyone's sure. familiar with tomatoes. They're just interested in some of these oddities. It's just kind of fascinating, at least in the plant vegetable world. So, you know, to hear or see tomatoes that are growing up to the second story, you're like, oh, that, you know, that's really cool. I got tomatoes in my garden, but I've never seen this. Same thing with pumpkins. Yeah, I got a 25-pounder pumpkin in my garden, but, you know, for someone to grow a 1,000 pounds, that's really kind of cool.
Yeah. I think it started the topic. I happened to be out in the Mifflinburg area visiting relatives, and there was this huge tomato for $3. $3 for one tomato? You would have had to see it, trust me. And I thought, well, I remember when Burpee Better Boy came out, or Big Boy, and they were terrible, and then Better Boy were smaller but tasted much better. But this one was huge, and it tasted fantastic. So, yeah, can be done. I wouldn't recommend just growing them for the sake of growing them large. You know, grow them to eat, and if you can grow them to eat and they taste fantastic like this one did, you know, more power to you. Something else you wanted to talk about was harvesting of asparagus that should be winding down by the end of June. Why is anybody even bothering with asparagus? Maybe that's just me.
I think that might be just you, Doug. I mean, I like asparagus. My wife prepares it a couple different ways, and it's some pretty good stuff. But so, you know, we're harvesting what we call spears. And so, you know, it emerges from the soil out of this overwintering structure, a lot of energy underground, and these spears come up, we harvest them and eat them. But if we would just harvest nonstop until to fall, everything that came up, we would deplete that energy reserve. And then it wouldn't be able to get in through the winter and re-sprout to come up again in the spring, the following spring. So at some point, we need to stop harvesting, allow those spears to grow up larger and, you know, put out their ferns. I don't know if you've ever seen an asparagus when it's in fern. Those are its leaves. Huh. And these tiny leaves are capturing that sunlight, producing energy, sending that back down into this rhizome structure, this underground structure, and storing that energy to get ready for next spring. So typically with our asparagus, you know, they've been producing now for several weeks. You can still harvest an established asparagus patch for a couple more weeks, but by the end of June or very early July, you probably want to stop harvesting those spears and allow that plant to recapture or to generate, regenerate that underground energy structure for the next year or the following year.
And what about trellising cucumbers?
Yeah, so if you're growing, you know, it depends on what kind of cucumbers you're growing. If you're doing kind of the bush cucumbers that don't really climb or are bigger vines, you don't need to do anything. But for some of these cucumber varieties that really vine just spread across the garden floor, maybe put up a trellis. I've seen a lot of people use these cattle panels, but you could use anything. You use chicken wire or whatever. But it keeps the fruit off the ground. It keeps the leaves kind of elevated. And it's one way to not eliminate, but to minimize some of the disease organisms that come in and just decimate cucumbers. And the big one here that we get every year is downy mildew. Downy mildew will wipe out a cucumber crop in a garden. It's not here yet, but it will be here shortly. And so if you can elevate these leaves so you have better air circulation, better drying of those leaves, that will really minimize that disease. Not eliminate it, but kind of give your cucumber plant maybe 2 or 3 more weeks of life before it succumbs to this disease.
Is there anything organic you can spray on it?
Yeah, there's some organic products. You know, for example, some of the copper products would be labeled for it. And it staves it off for a while, but a lot of times with these organic products, they only protect the leaf surface that gets the spray on it. So underneath, on the underside of the leaves, usually our spraying equipment just can't get there. And when we spray, we're spraying everything over top. It hits the surface, the top surface of the leaf, protects that area, but it does nothing on the underside of the surface. So, you know, a lot of our diseases reside on the underside of the leaf or colonize the underside of the leaf. Some of the newer types of fungicides that a lot of our commercial growers use, they have what we call translaminar activity, meaning they can hit the surface, the top surface of the leaf, but they can migrate or penetrate the leaf and protect the lower portion of the leaf surface. So they have access to some of these products that are give you better control on these foliar diseases. Homeowners don't really have access to a lot of those products, or they do, but they're so they're pricey. I mean, yeah. Buy a gallon of the stuff that would last you 40 years because you just have a small little garden patch. It just makes no sense to buy it.
It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen. Tom Butzler is with Penn State Cooperative Extension, and he's a horticulture educator. We were talking about some gardening tips for this spring and into the summer, and something that people are eager to do. Oh, that looks terrible. I'll get that out of the garden. I'll just pull it out. I'll cut it out. You don't want to do that on the bulbs just yet.
No. You're spot on that one. Daffodils and other bulbs, they're great for providing color in the spring. I mean, you have a large bed of it, and it really brightens up a spot. But once that flowering season is done, what are you looking at, Doug? I mean, it's these large blades, and, they start flopping over a little bit, or they're not providing any color, not a uniform stand like a blade of grass. They're kind of all over the place. So there's nothing really attractive about them at this point. And so you do have some homeowners are like, all right, enough. I'm going to cut all that green growth out, and then you put in annuals or whatever they do. And the mistake there is you got to allow those bulbs to regenerate that energy for next season. That green material is capturing that sunlight and through a chemical process, making it into energy, and it sends that energy down into those bulbs underground, where it just kind of holds that energy reserve until next year, which will put out new flowers. So yeah, you got to hold back and just wait until that green top starts to really yellow and almost brown. Then you can cut it back.
Yeah, because I mean, you would normally think that you're doing the plant a favor by cleaning it up and making it look better,
yeah.
And it's just going to make it less healthy for the next season.
Right. Yeah, if you would cut them back now, you wouldn't kill them. There's enough energy to put up a growth or a flush of flowers next year, but it may not be as much. It may not be as many flowers, and you're going to slowly weaken that plant. And if you do that after a couple years of removing that foliage before it's time, you're just going to weaken the plant, and they'll eventually just give away and die off.
Point of diminishing returns, it gets less return each year. So
yes,
yeah, why
exactly.
Do that? Something else that you said in your notes that you sent here, you weren't sure whether we discussed it. I think we had, but we hadn't really done a deep dive into the April hard freeze that we had. What has that done?
Yeah.
What are we dealing with now because of that?
It's not really a big problem with our vegetable farmers, because if anything was planted in April, it was under protected plastics, like, for example, high tunnel or greenhouse tomatoes. And typically they have heat units in there to heat up that space. So anything was outside was subjected to these temperatures, and we didn't have peppers, we didn't have tomatoes outside. But the thing, the big crop that's really going to hurt Pennsylvania that we had outside was our fruit trees. And in normal times, maybe we could have withstood that weather event in April. And the what I'm referring to is the one, I think it was like April 20th and 21st, is where, at least in central Pennsylvania, we got down to about 20 or 21 degrees.
Yay.
Now, that's not that cold when you compare it to what it was like in January, where we were about 5 degrees. But at that time in January, our plants have hardened off. They're able to withstand those cold temperatures and just kind of hang out and wait for things to warm up. And that's exactly what happened, Doug, is things started warming up earlier than normal, or we got a heat spike. And I think it was in March or early April where we had temperatures for several days that were in the 80s.
Yeah.
And these plants responded to this 80-degree weather by saying, oh, my gosh, it's getting warm up. Let's wake up. it's time to start, you know, growing and doing our thing. So they came out of this dormancy period, or dormancy, think hibernation almost, like, but come out of this dormancy, and they started, you know, loosening those restrictions that gave them the ability to survive cold temperatures. And so, you know, the cells started dividing, blossoms started to come out, blooms and so forth. And then we were hit with this 20-degree weather in April, and these plants could not survive. Now, it didn't kill these fruit trees, but it killed the tender growth, basically the buds, emerging blossoms, and so forth. And so for our fruit tree industry, Doug, I mean, they're talking about a 95% loss.
I haven't
checked the latest news on it, but I know Governor Shapiro, he was asking for a declaration of an emergency, and I think he got it. But he was saying that they're expecting anywhere from $100 to $200 million loss because of this freeze in our fruit tree industry. So
people don't understand how big of an industry that is in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
But they love getting the fruit when they go to the supermarket, or more likely, if you can, go to the roadside stand and buy it direct from the grower. But it's, that's going to be a problem when it comes to prices over the summer and into the fall, availability. Yeah. And, of course, the farmer lost a lot of their livelihood on that.
Yeah, and that's the big thing. I mean, when you go to the supermarket, Doug, we're going to be able to buy peaches all summer long. That's not going to be a problem.
They'll bring them in from someplace else.
Exactly. So the supermarket's not going to hurt. The Pennsylvania consumer, you know, it's not going to hurt them so much that they won't get it. They may have to pay a little more.
Yeah.
But they'll still have access to peaches. But it's our growers. What do you do now when you lose 95% of your inventory for the year? And so that's one of the reasons that, you know, we have some of these backstops where, you know, government can come in. And, you know, that's why the governor wanted this a declaration of emergency, so some funds could be released and growers can apply for some help, because that's tough. Now, you know, some operations might be able to paper over that a little bit, in the sense they're very diversified. You know, maybe they have a small apple orchard, and then maybe they have 10 acres of pumpkins and tomatoes and so forth. So they'll have things coming off, their farm, but they won't have that fruit. But there are other operations that are almost 100% fruit trees. That's their niche. And so that was a big loss, that hard freeze back in April. This was nothing to do with the cold winter temperatures that we experienced in, you know, like February. Our trees can survive those kind of events, but not what happened in April.
I would imagine most of those growers already know the channels to go to get some type of relief or to apply for that.
Yeah. So, you know, there's plenty of organizations out there, associations, government entities that are working with them. And so, you know, they can apply for them if that's what they want. You know, there might be some individuals that don't want to reach out. But, that's not going to be a problem notifying growers that were hit hard by this how to get some financial help.
Yeah, it's just a shame that they have to go through that. But it is the part of the cycle of nature, as some years are going to be fantastic and others are not going to be, but the bills keep coming no matter what.
Right. And, you know, I think that's one thing the non-agriculture community doesn't really realize, is that farming is difficult. You know, whether it's an agronomic type crop such as corn or soybeans, but these vegetables and fruit crops, it's hard because you're not in a factory where you can control almost every element. You're outside, and there are so many variables that are that go into growing, and so you have no control whatsoever over weather. You know, whether it's too much rain or lack of rain, where you don't get any for 3 months, or we hit a heat wave where it's 95 degrees for 3 weeks, and you just got to be able to be quick, nimble, and adjust. And sometimes I think that's hard for the non-ag community to kind of realize. It's just some of the difficulties in growing things.
Well, you know, it's like you ask a child, where does milk come from? And they say the corner store or the supermarket, because they haven't made the connection yet. Unfortunately, a lot of them grow up and still haven't made the connection, but that's another story. Other things we want to talk about, we usually talk about pests sooner or later. You wanted to mention something about flea beetles on eggplant this year?
Yeah, that's just a reoccurring pest. I just put down a list of possible topics for your vegetable garden, and this is one that occurs every year: flea beetles. And what they'll do is they're very tiny little black insects. You can see them with the naked eye, but you see their damage before you actually see them. And they've got these chewing mouth parts, and they just chew little holes into the eggplant leaf. And if they're not controlled, they can really remove a lot of the leaf over time. It just looks like someone came by with a shotgun, and it just these holes all over the leaf. And so you might want to control there's organic ways to do that. You can use something like neem oil. There are some synthetic insecticides that are effective. If you don't want to use any of those, an easy way is just to get some of that, we call it Remate, like a finely spun cloth that you kind of drape over the plant. Air circulates through it, sunlight can penetrate it pretty good, and it just serves as a barrier for this insect. They're flying around and moving about, but then they can't get to the leaf. And if you don't control it, I've never really seen it kill a plant, but it's going to reduce the amount of amount of eggplant that it produces. And that might not be a bad thing, Doug, because I always plant eggplant every year, and half the time I don't know what to do with them. I just throw them in the compost pile.
Or they end up in the neighbor's porch when they're not looking.
Yeah, and they're one of the easiest plants to grow. And every year I plant them, I'm like, okay, I'm going to come up with a recipe for eggplant. I think we talked about this last year. And I'm just so busy, or I don't feel like eggplant. And they just rot. I only eat a couple a year.
We had a neighbor who did eggplant parmesan, and it was really good. Yeah. Would I go out and try to grow a bunch of eggplants to have it? No.
Yeah, that's one thing I can do. I made some eggplant parmesan, and it is good. But, you can't have eggplant parmesan every day. So.
Yeah, I tried, not last year, the year before, I tried a potted eggplant that I got at one of the nurseries. And it's just, man, I think I finally lost it when I was away for vacation for a week, and I was not able to water it and tend to it as much as I could. And it just decided, I'm not coming back from this. Because we just had a dry spell.
That's a good point. Just, something that, as we're going into summer, Doug, that potted plants, whether they're vegetables or flowers, need to be treated a little differently than plants that are in your garden or in the landscape. Those pots do tend to dry out faster. It's elevated and water drains out of there a little quicker. A lot of times it doesn't have the water-holding capacity that our soil does. So, that's a good point. Just be aware, if you're going away for a couple days, maybe bring that potted plant off the sidewalk and put it on the porch where it's shaded a little bit, just so it doesn't dry out as fast.
WRTA Weekend, Doug Herendeen from Penn State Cooperative Extension, horticulture educator Tom Butzler is with us. And a couple of things we wanted to finish up with as far as spring to summer gardening now is maybe succession planting. And my dad did this to a certain extent after a number of years. He used to just plant everything at the same time and let it go. And if something went fallow in a small part of the garden, and we're not talking acres here, we're talking a backyard, but it was half the backyard by the time he was done. My mother was just like, just leave me enough for the clothesline, okay? Back when everybody was still using them. But the idea, I guess, with succession is you're going to be able to keep the garden going with different things all summer?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So, right now, coming out of winter, it's cold and people want something fresh coming out of the garden. They plant the majority of their garden, the past couple weeks up to, now or another couple weeks. So they plant everything in the garden, and that's great. But one of the problems or things you run into is that some of these crops they'll produce, and then they're done, and then you have nothing the rest of the growing season. So, for example, Doug, sweet corn or snap beans, you plant that crop, it produces, you harvest, and that crop is done. What do you do if you want sweet corn a couple weeks later or a month later from your last harvest? And so the idea is that for snap beans, for example, or sweet corn, is that maybe every 2 weeks, you plant a crop of snap beans. You plant a row or a couple rows of sweet corn so that you have a continual harvest of these things coming out of your garden. So that would be things like, I mentioned two of them, your beans, sweet corn, radishes. We're kind of beyond the lettuce, but you could do that early in the season with lettuce, you know, plant every couple weeks. But to continually plant, now, that's for 2 weeks is good for, as I mentioned, sweet corn or snap beans. And then maybe every 4 weeks, start a new crop of things like zucchini and a squash, maybe even cucumbers if you can avoid downy mildew on these cucumbers. Because, again, those will run their course, and then you get into maybe September and you don't have any cucumbers. You don't have any zucchini because that plant has just gotten kind of old and weathered and it's just starting to crash and burn. So, you know, there's plenty of tables and charts out there, you know, online that look at this idea of, you know, if I want a continual harvest of snap beans until the frost, when do I plant them? Same thing with zucchini, squash, and so forth.
It's kind of hard to mess up radishes. That was the first thing my dad had me plant to learn how to take care of it and space it and do all that. It was kind of a letdown because at the time I really couldn't stand radishes in the salad. Because I'm a kid, what do I know? It's not my favorite now, but it's like, okay, I can understand they're useful at least. But yeah, something like that works out pretty well.
For a beginner garden, for anyone that's listening, and they're not sure, you know, if they could do vegetable gardening, that is the crop you start with, the radishes. They're kind of, can I say idiot-proof on the radio?
Yeah, I suppose so. Hey, they were idiot-proof in my case. I mean, all I had been doing up to that point was weeding the garden, which I despised, but, well, what are you going to do?
Those are so easy to start and grow. Now, a couple things you need to be aware of radishes. One, they're a really short-season crop. You know, 30 days after planting, after seeding in the ground, you could be harvesting radishes. They're that fast.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, if you let them go too long, then they become kind of woody, too mature, and so now they're not suitable for anything. So this is a crop you really have to pay attention to, is that after about 30 or 40 days, you need to start harvesting that. Yeah, and I'll agree with you. I don't like radishes in my salad, but my wife the other night, I brought in a bunch of radishes. I had some red and white radishes, and she roasted them, and that takes away some of that bite or that peppery taste you have on raw radishes, and they were pretty good. I liked them.
Now I've never heard of doing that. You roast them?
Yeah, roasted radishes. I'm not sure what kind of oil she used, and I think that was all maybe some pepper and salt, and I think that was it. And yeah, that's pretty good. So they, you know, you roast them to they're pretty tender. Just she had them where there was just a little bit of crunch in them, but for the most part tender. And I thought it was pretty good.
Well, you season it. You put some olive oil with it, or what?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what you used, olive oil, yeah.
Yeah. It just reminds me, we have one of our listeners, Dan, who used to call in when we were live Monday through Friday on the show, and he had asked about some black radishes sometime, and I had never heard of them, and sure enough, there are, and we found some black radish seeds. I presume that they were successful for him, but yeah, it's there's different varieties of that stuff out there that either they're not as well-known or... For one reason or another, they're not as popular. But if you get bored of the same old, you look around in some of the seed catalogs where you can take out a second mortgage to buy some of that stuff.
Yeah.
But you can also find what's there. But you know what? In some of the seed catalogs, if they're very, very expensive stuff, look on eBay, look on Amazon, and you might just find it for dirt cheap compared.
Well, you know, that's not surprising. I've never heard of black radishes either. But, you know, when you think of tomatoes, I mean, there are so many different tomatoes out there. But when you go to a hardware store or whatever store, when you look for tomatoes, your options are really, really limited. You know, they don't have, you know, you open
heirloom.
Up a catalog and look at tomatoes, it's just pages and pages and pages.
Yeah.
So it's no different, I would think, with radishes. You're right. I don't open up a garden catalog and look at radish variety. That's just not my thing. So when I go buy radish seed, I'm just going to the store and my options are the common red ones and the common white ones. So, yeah, I'm sure there's black ones out there. I never look for them.
Yeah, I just find it interesting to see what you can get, especially when you get tomatoes, some of the heirloom varieties. If you go to some of the farm stands, you'll find stuff you will not find in the supermarket. But the supermarket's job is to sell produce and move it fast. They're going to get the most popular varieties. They're not going to carry 100 different. I'm sure that there are some stores, specialty shops, that do things exactly like that. And if anybody knows them around here, let me know. Doug@LightnerRadio.com. But, yeah, it's nice to be able to think outside the box and look for other stuff like that if you can. But there's a reason why it's just... But here's the thing. If you do look at the catalogs and you see a bunch of different seeds that you know you don't have in your store, that's another plus to try those. So you know you can't get them anywhere else. If you're successful with them, great, fantastic. If not, well, try something else next time.
I mean, seeds aren't that expensive compared to like a cruise in the Caribbean or something. And so I think that's one of the fun things or neat things about gardening. You get to experiment a little bit. So maybe you spend a couple bucks on black radish seed, for example. Really, in the whole scheme of things, that's relatively minor, and it gives you a chance to kind of play around and try something different.
Well, also, with any type of radish, like you said, there's a certain amount of time there. 30 days can be an eternity for a kid during summer, unless it's the 30 days before school starting again, which, by the way, I already saw somebody putting out back-to-school stuff last week where school hadn't ended. So, you know, let's not hurry things up, okay?
Come on, Doug. After July 4th, we're going to start seeing the Christmas plays up. So that's not surprising.
Well, at least July 4th is when I usually see the back-to-school stuff pop up. Yeah. But here this was, I mean, we hadn't even gotten to – I guess it was Memorial Day weekend. I saw it in a store, and they're putting out back-to-school. It's like, no, put this away. Get it out of my sight. And kids here, for the kids that listen to talk radio, here's the thing. No matter how old you get, there's still that tug at you when you see a back-to-school sale. You remember what it was like. Also, kids, just remember, at least you go back to school. Once you graduate, you're working all year long.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. When we were talking about succession planting, you had here listed on doing beans and then cilantro. Not to let cilantro go to seed. And I don't mess with cilantro, so you tell me why that's important.
So cilantro, people grow cilantro to put into their salsas. You know, if you're growing tomatoes and onions, a lot of people like to make their own salsa sauce. And cilantro is an ingredient for many. So I always start a couple cilantro plants. In 1 year, I let my cilantro plants just go. I didn't really pay attention. It was kind of in the corner of the garden. And so it went to seed. And you harvest the seed, and you can make coriander, another type of spice or herb that people use in, dishes. But the problem with letting cilantro go to seed is then the next year, I've got cilantro all over my garden.
It's like onion sets.
Oh, my gosh. So, now I'm pulling cilantro that normally I would grow for a crop. I'm pulling it because it's a weed. So, you just got to be careful of some of these things. And you learn as you garden. I knew kind of what was going to happen. I just kind of ignored it. And maybe it was because that summer was really hot, and I didn't feel like going out and removing the cilantro, prevent it from going to the seed or whatever. But, yeah.
Yeah. And one other quick thing about deadheading of flowers, some are going to be blooming all year and some are all, not all year, but all summer. And some are going to be over quickly. Which do you deadhead? Which do you not?
Yeah, one thing, like, for example, some of the varieties of zinnias is that, once they are done flowering, they'll start setting seed. And, when the plant is setting seed, it's diverting its energy into the future. And if you can remove that flower after it's spent, it's starting to, the petals are falling off, remove it, that plant's going to send more energy into flower production instead of seed production. So, if this is, you're on a road, a lot of people passing by, and you want things to just look good all year round, is to go out every once in a while and deadhead, remove those flowers that are senescing or dying off, and prevent it from going to seed so that plant is just pushing new flowers.
Yeah. Well, it's like coleus. It gets these, some of them are blue, some of them are other colors, but it gets like a little spike of a flower. You think, oh, that looks cute, except now it's going to go to seed. If you want the plant to get bushier or whatever, pinch that off and let it keep growing.
Yeah, exactly. You're trying to prevent reproductive growth and put in for this vegetative growth in that instance. But, with deadheading of flowers, you just want to push new flower growth.
I think we do that most with rose bushes, right?
Yeah, we do that. Some people do that with roses. Yep.
Yeah. We're about out of time, but if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Yeah, you can call me at my office. I probably won't be in much during the growing season because I'm not running around visiting farms. But you can call me, 570-726-0022. I do prefer email because a lot of times people have questions and I like pictures to kind of go with the words to, you know, show me the problem or the issue. So you can send me an email at tmb124@psu.edu.
Tom Butzler from Penn State Cooperative Extension, thanks very much.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Doug.
Podcast the program up on WRTA.com in minutes.